Weekly News Magazine recreate from the pages of Time the first week of the United States at War. The March of Time. Sunday, December 7th, 1941. The eastward rolling earth seals off the night. Gray light kindles low over the dark Pacific. It is almost dawn. There is a distant booming, but it is not the boom of the sea. In the western half of the United States, it is mid-morning. Search time for thousands. Almighty God, who has given us this good land for our heritage, we humbly beseech thee that we may always prove ourselves a people mindful of thy favor and glad to do thy will. Bless our land with honorable industry, sound learning, and pure manners. Save us from violence, discord, and confusion, from pride and arrogancy, and from every evil way. Defend our liberty and fashion into one united people the multitude brought hither out of many kindreds and tongues. While in the United States, churchgoers are hearing the common prayer for their country in critical times, in Honolulu it is 7:50 a.m., not even Sunday breakfast time. A lawyer named Roy Gittlesack is warming up the motor of his little private plane.
Spinning overnight, Mr. Gittlesack?
Yes. Great morning for flying, isn't it?
Yeah. Just a handful of clouds. And not a plane in the sky.
Right. Well, come on.
Come on.
Thousand feet aloft, Lawyer Roy Vitosek levels off. Looks down at the green loaf-shaped island of Oahu. Then Roy Vitosek looks south to Coco Head. Coming directly toward him steadily, swiftly on four big black warning planes. They are nearly upon him before Lawyer Vitosek can see that they are not the warcraft of his own country. December 7th, 1941. It is 2:05 p.m. The Washington office of Secretary of State Cordell Hull. Japanese envoys Nomura and Kurosu arrived 15 minutes late for an appointment with Mr. Hull. Minutes passed as the tardy envoys, constantly consulting their watches, return the level stare of the bronze Lafayette from Washington, surveying them from across the room. Then, ushered into the office, Tennessee and Cordell Hull.
Come in, gentlemen. Take a seat.
Thank you.
Yes. You have your government answer to our government proposals of November 26th?
Yes.
Let's see what it says. The United States is conspiring with Great Britain and the Far East. Both the United States and Great Britain have resorted to every possible measure to obstruct the establishment of peace. Japanese government cannot tolerate, in view of the attitude of the American government, it is impossible to reach an agreement. Mr. Nomura, I must say that in all my 50 years of public service, I have never seen a document that was more crowded with infamous falsehoods and distortions. Infamous falsehoods and distortions on a scale so huge that I never imagined until this day that any government on this planet was capable of uttering them.
Monday, December 7th, 1941. It is 2:20 p.m. under the great White House portico. A uniformed United States soldier jumps from an army car, hurries up the steps.
Order from the Chief of Staff office. Here's a sealed message from the decoding room at the Army Communications Office. Must be shown to the President immediately.
Monday, December 7th, 1941. It is 2:25 p.m. in the almost deserted Washington office of Phil Peacock of the Associated Press.
What have you got for the night wire, Bill?
Nothing much. Routine Sunday stuff. I'll get it. Associated Press.
Hello, Bill. This is Steve Ernie.
Oh, hello, Steve. Where are you? At the White House?
No, I'm calling from home. I've got the UP and the IRS in the same wire.
Yeah, well, what's up?
I have a statement here that the president just called up and asked me to read. Quote, the Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor from the air and all military and naval activities on the island of Oahu, the principal American base in the Hawaiian Islands. End quote. I'm going directly to the White House now. I'll tell you more later.
That'll Steve Early. Yeah? Round up the staff and get him in here. I'm going over to the White House. We're in the war.
Operator. Operator, this is the Associated Press Office in Honolulu. How about my call to San Francisco?
One moment, please. I think I finally reached your party.
Oh, good.
Go ahead, please.
This is the
YP
Bartell speaking.
Hello, this is Burns, Eugene Burns in Honolulu. We're being bombed.
Yeah, Burns, we got a flash from Washington, but no details.
The attack is still going on. I'll give you what dope I have. Ready?
Go ahead.
From 50 to 150 Japanese bombers, dive bombers, and pursuit ships assaulted the island of Oahu this morning. At 8:10 a.m., the first squadron came roaring in from the southeast over Diamond Head. Streak northward over Pearl Harbor. Got that, Bartell?
Right.
The bombers circled over U.S. Navy's Ford Island plane base in the harbor center. Dive bombers dropped to within 100 feet of the harbor surface. Launched torpedoes at the many U.S. warships lying at anchor. From nearby Hickam Field, U.S. Army plane base, rose a barrage of anti-aircraft fire as a second wave of Japanese planes approached. The enemy...
Hey, Jake, that bomb was falling way close to you.
Yeah, it did. Somebody tells me I'd better give the rest of this report back. Well, here we go. The enemy scored direct hits on Hickam Field barracks, killed over 100 U.S. soldiers. Wheeler Field got a blast on its hangars. Honolulu got incendiary bombs. Northward, machine gun fire raked the streets of the town of Waiawa.
Just a minute, Gene. What town was that?
Waiawa.
Okay, go ahead.
In Pearl Harbor, smoke rose as one vessel was set afire and another exploded. Other vessels steamed from Pearl Harbor in search of Japanese plane carriers. Getting this okay?
Just get that last part. Will you repeat?
Oh, Bartell? Hello? Hello? Say, operator, can I get this call through?
Thus, after 23 years and 25 days of peace, the United States was plunged into its seventh major conflict. The attacker of the Japanese Empire, whose windows the U.S. had opened on the world just 88 years ago. In Washington, the White House announces 1,500 killed, another 1,500 wounded. Admits the loss of one capital ship, one destroyer. As the fateful news reaches the 132 million peace-loving, peace-making American people, by radio, press, and neighborly word of mouth, these are some reactions. In San Francisco, it is just church time. A motorist drives into a filling station.
Better fill her up with ethyl. You're back.
Well, what do you think of those jets?
Yes? What jets?
They just bombed Pearl Harbor.
Are you kidding?
Just this minute, got over the radio.
Well, what do you know?
Yeah. Thanks, this is it.
Yeah. Hey, just now down the street, I almost hit a Jap on a motorcycle. Guess I should have run over it.
On the Cumberland Plateau in Tennessee, it is just after Sunday dinner. Sergeant Alvin Cullum York, legendary World War I hero, is told the news.
We got to put up a united front and give those folks a licking right away. Take care of the Japs first, and then take on the Germans.
As they struck the Russians at Port Arthur in 1904, while their ambassador danced before the Tsar, so once more the Japanese had delivered a copperhead punch. Their aim, to divide the U.S. fleet at Hawaii and Manila. Prevent a unified British-American blow on the Japanese fleet as it steamed to attack Singapore. Guam, Wake, and Midway Island. And soon the Philippines are raided by the far-flung Japanese. In Portland, Maine, the afternoon movies are beginning. Says one Yankee.
I'll be sure of one thing. Up to today, I wondered whether we were another France. You saw. But now we'll see that Americans can fight in the old way. I know many people can.
For the U.S., on this first Sunday afternoon, it becomes plain that this war will have to be won the hard way. Farther down the coast in Martha's Vineyard, famed player Charles A. Lindbergh formally ends the cause of isolation.
He is now turning every effort to building the greatest and most efficient army, navy, and air force in the world. When American soldiers go to war, it must be with the best equipment that modern skill can design and that modern industry can build.
The historic Sunday of December 7th ends. It is Monday, December 8th, 1941. At 12:25 p.m. in the chambers of the House of Representatives, members of the House and Senate hold a joint session, knowing that 20 hours and 25 minutes before, Japan had declared war on the United States and Great Britain. That Britain and the first of 18 other nations had declared war on Japan. Every important government official in Washington is present as Franklin Delano Roosevelt delivers his historic message. But none is more attentive than a group of 25 top-ranking officers in the Navy's Bureau of Aeronautics. These officers, some gray-haired force drivers, a few commanders and a few of lesser rank, gather in the office of their chief, their Admiral Jack Powers, to hear the President's words by witness.